The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Heretics Hour on this November 12th, 2012. We're really getting in deeply into fall here and actually looking forward to Thanksgiving here in the United States, aren't we? I'm coming to you live from the White Network for the next 2 hours, and I'm expecting Kevin McDonald to call in the second hour if he can maneuver our system, which will be his first time in doing that, and we do it a little different than some others because we don't have the capacity, or at least I don't, to call. I guess they have to call in here, so we hope that that will take place all right. And in this first hour, I want to talk some about the election that we just had, the national elections, and what the outcome has shown us, and why it is so important to us, and what it's not only what it's telling us, but what we need to do if we want to take advantage of what we've learned, or if we want to do something for ourselves and our people besides continuing to talk about it. It's really tough. I know it's tough, but our new mantra, I think, should be vote white. And, you know, it just so happens that my partner Tan Stoffel, my partner here at the White Network, put up a new blog at his Age of Treason website, and he titled it Vote White. And I, you know, that is really the message that we need to be thinking about now. I voted white this time. You know, I'll just go on and repeat a little bit why I voted in this election at all, because I didn't intend to vote. I intended to be one of those many white people that we've discovered sat it out, because I didn't like either candidate particularly. But as it got closer to the election, maybe a few weeks before, and I started reading some of the things a little bit more, and reading some things about Obama, and I just thought, my gosh, how can I sit this out when we have a white person, a white candidate opposing a black candidate, or a candidate of color, if you prefer, because he's not exactly black, I guess, mulatto. But why? It's such a clear-cut thing, because it's not, while I don't like all the policies of Romney for sure, I think that the policies of Obama are absolutely opposed to the direction that I think we should be going in. So as I looked at it, I thought, gee, I'm going to vote for Romney, and I all of a sudden liked Romney a whole lot better as I just compared him to Obama and, you know, put the two of them together. So I wrote a little blog about that on my website, carolynyeager.com, and explained why. It also has to do with what I think are Obama's sexual orientation, which I do believe is homosexual. And also I'm very much opposed to the introduction of gay marriage and gay lifestyle and so on as normal, and bringing it into encouraging our children to see it that way, just changing everything in the culture in this country, and it's going full speed ahead. It will really go full speed ahead now that he has won re-election. It's got 4 more years, but so I voted white. I voted for that reason. And those who say, oh, nobody should do that, you know, that's not a good, you know, who put that down, well, we've got an answer to that now, because we see that all of the non-whites voted for color. They voted for non-white. You know, they voted in a block almost. for the non-white candidate. So, you know, as we look at all of these details, we can see that this gives us not only more impetus, but also it gives us the justification to vote white in our own interests and to argue that point and to talk about it openly and not to be apologetic about it. In the first place, the vast majority of blacks, and a lot of you I know are aware of this, but I'm going to go over it anyway for whatever help it might be in focusing on this issue. The vast majority of blacks who are the second largest voting bloc after whites don't know about issues. They don't care about issues. They vote color, you know, or if there would be two white men, they'd vote Democrat. They'd vote for the one who was promising the most things to people of color. So in that sense, they're still voting color. They're not voting. They're not thinking what's good for the nation. They don't think about that at all. There are some who call into talk shows and of not just blacks, but what are called Hispanics and so on too, and others who call into talk shows and pretend like they really care about issues. Some of them are Republicans. They say they are, and they're you know, concerned about constitutional issues and so on. But I don't know, since 95% of black people voted for Obama, or let's say, in more exactly, it was 93% overall in the nation. That seems to be the proper number. Then these people that call into these shows and act like they're all friendly with the whites and so on are very much in a very tiny minority. So the vast majority of Mexicans and other mestizos have only one issue. And that's might not be voting for a black person, but it's what's good for Mexicans. And, of course, any Mexican or a mestizo-type candidate, Cuban or anything like that, would be those who really could be considered Hispanics, would be their choice. And as we all know, and we keep saying, they're not looked down upon for doing that, for voting their race or their ethnicity at all. They also don't care what's good for America. They're not thinking along those lines. They're only thinking about what's good for us. And then you have the Asians and Jews who also vote for the most non-white party, no matter what the issues are, it seems, because in this election, Asians and Jews voted overwhelmingly for Obama. Well, Jews voted for Obama in the last election, but I don't know what the Asians did. I didn't either read about it or it wasn't talked about or something now, but probably they voted Democrat, but they really voted Democrat this time. We'll get some figures in a minute. What this tells us is that since everybody is voting non-white, against whites, no matter what else is happening, then we whites better get in step with this, and we better vote white. Is this the new politics? You know, vote your race. This might be the new politics, and it's vote your race in a country where race has now emerged as respectable. I would say, isn't it respectable if everybody's voting race? How can we say that it's not? It's only not respectable if whites vote race. Well, we better just ignore that, say, too bad, you know, and say what you want, but we're going to vote our race, because if we did, we would win. If we did, we would still win. But the obstacles to us doing that are something that I'll also go into. So if we say that now it's okay to be racist, or maybe that's too strong a word for many people. How about racial? It's okay to be, it's okay to prefer your own race to be the government over you, be the people who have positions in the in your society over you, to rule over you. It's okay for everyone, so it should be okay for us. And if we can't even say that much, you know, if we can't even go that far openly and in our talking, then there's something wrong. Except the only thing that comes up here to get in the way of a nice picture where we could just write every, you know, make everything right again, is that not all whites like whites. They prefer the non-whites too. For whatever reason they have, they're in the sense leftover communist, overly liberal internationalists who want this integrated world, want this multicultural world, and they think even though these non-whites don't rule well, don't do a good job, it's okay because they're not so white and so racist. So this is the problem that we have with so many whites that do not love their race like all the other people seem to love their race. We have to look at what is wrong with us. Well, we've looked at that quite a bit, and Professor Kevin McDonald has looked at that quite a bit, and we'll see what he has to say about that when he comes on. But it's time, you know. Another thing I would say is that it's time to bite the bullet, you know. And in our speaking to one another and in our writing and so on, we need to overcome hesitations that we've had and bite the bullet and do what we need to do because the time is getting very short. I looked up bite the bullet on Wikipedia to see what they had to say about it, because I tend to use that phrase a lot. It's just something I guess I was familiar with over my life or something. It's a common phrase that's been used, and so I say it. Actually, if you're interested, I'll tell you, whether you are or not, that it means to endure a painful or otherwise unpleasant situation that is seen as unavoidable. Well, that's what we're in now. We're in a situation that is unavoidable. It's unpleasant, and it might even be painful to do what needs to be done. But in any case, it does need to be done. So, did you know that the phrase was first recorded by Rudyard Kipling in his 1891 novel, The Light That Failed? And it also may have evolved from the British Empire expression to bite the cartridge, which dates to the Indian Rebellion of 1857. In this version of the etymology, the idea of tolerating necessary hardship refers to the British wish that the sepoys would ignore any small presence of animal fat in their paper cartridges. And in philosophy, it is has a more specific meaning of to accept unpleasant consequences of one's assumed beliefs. So, you know, I like that. I'm going into this because to understand how we are now facing the consequences of things that have been going on for a long time. And if we have the belief of loving and caring for our own people, white people, and saving the society, white society, with all of its values and qualities and characteristics and so on. We have to accept that there's some unpleasant situation that we're in, and there's things we have to do. And one thing we have to do is join in as under the flag of white. You know, we have to admit that we care about whites, that we're for whites, and we're going to be for whites over and against everything else, and that is going to be our position until we can get our situation straightened out, where we have a stronger, or we're in a stronger position again. This is what you do in order to sustain a consistent set of beliefs. You know, if you're going to have a consistent set of beliefs, you have to accept that there may be something disturbing that's a consequence of your beliefs, and this is it may be counterintuitive, like for people who think that to not embrace everyone in the United States as Americans and so on, that may be what they think is sounds right, but it may not fit with our set of beliefs. Our beliefs end up saying that this is this doesn't fit in there, you know. And if we're going to follow our beliefs, we have to accept all the consequences and act in accordance. I didn't explain that very well, but some people can't bite the bullet. You know, they don't want to bite the bullet, and they have written the Republican Party off even before the election. They say that when it goes over the cliff in 4 years' time, some Republicans will be ready to come toward the right. Well, the new right, or the hard right, the far right. Well, in my opinion, for those, that won't be a very far distance to travel. But that's not really what we're after. What we're after is not so much. I don't know if it's the Republican Party, but the Republican Party is an entity that we shouldn't throw away so quickly. Although it may be that the Republican Party cannot deal with biting the bullet and is going to go the other way, which it probably is. It's talking now about taking in going after the Hispanics, especially. That's who it wants to go after, the Hispanics. It thinks it has a better chance with that. But it doesn't. Let's see. We're a lot of people, as I said already, can't come together as white. But I think we should make the effort. I think the effort needs to be made to point out now how the others are coming together under their own racial banners, and we should why therefore it's okay for us to do the same. Now, I'm going to look at a couple of articles that appeared last week, crunching the numbers of the election and what they mean and so on. And the first one is from that American Renaissance, written by Henry Wolfe. I'm sure a lot of people have looked at that. It's very well done. It helped me a lot, gave me some good information. But one thing we have to say about AMRIN is that they want to separate from the blacks and the browns, but the Jews and the Asians are okay with them. So let's see what they say about that in this article. So Henry Wolfe says that talks about the spread, the extraordinary spread in the white vote. That some were, in some places in the country, it is so strongly white. My phone is ringing. I'm just ignoring it. It is so strongly white voters who voted for Romney, and others so strongly white voters who voted for Obama. And So in Mississippi, which we shouldn't be surprised at, 89% of whites voted for Romney. But in Vermont, only 33% of whites voted for Romney. So, he asked the question, do these states even belong in the same union? So there's a huge gap where you are in the country as to what kind of a white voter you are. And it's 59% of whites voted for Romney. It seems to be the general figure. But whites who live in the federal capital, Washington, D.C. area, many of whom work for the federal government, only 12% voted for Romney. So there's a huge disconnect here, whereas in general, 59% of us whites voted for Romney, but only 12% in our nation's capital, and which says that our government is out of touch with so many of the American white people. They really are representing non-whites, basically. And one thing that I was looking at an electoral map on that somebody had, some big site had put up, and you could get a lot of information from it. And it showed me looking at all that mass of red in the middle of the country and going off to the west a little bit and south here and there and so on. This huge mass of red looked so big, so impressive. And it showed a huge rejection of Obama in states like Utah, where Romney got 72%, in a state like Wyoming, Romney got 68%. In Idaho, Romney got 64% of the vote. But the thing is, there's not so many people in these places, but there's a lot of territory. But when I was thinking about land, I realized that in Wyoming and Idaho, I'm sure a whole lot of the land is owned by the government. It's national park land, particularly in Wyoming, even more so. So when you look at all this big area, but you can't say, well, whites are there, you know, and if we built that up, you know, we could make that a white place, you know, a white safety place, because the federal government owns most of the land there, and you couldn't use it. You couldn't. I mean, I think so. You know, this is something to consider. But anyway, it looks good on the map, and in West Virginia, 62% of white people voted for Romney. And in Nebraska, Kansas, Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky, Alabama, around 60% went 60% for Romney. And in Texas and Louisiana, it was over 55%. And the others, you know, all the way down to around 51, 52, and so on. So, There's this huge, the people in certain areas of this country really rejected Obama. They just reject Obama. But in other places, they embrace Obama. And these places, have more people in them. So, if we, only counted votes cast by whites, Obama would have only received 68 electoral college votes. 68. That's the white people. The white people of this country did not elect Barack Obama. By contrast, if we counted only votes cast by non-whites, Romney would not have won a single electoral vote. So the non-whites don't support Romney at all. And not a single state in which even a single minority group, whether black, Hispanic, or Asian, gave Mr. Romney a majority of their votes. Not a single state, how does that go? Not a single state in which even a single minority group, in no state of the United States did any minority group, any of them, whether black, Hispanic, or Asian, none of them gave Romney a majority. So they completely reject any white man, any white candidate, in favor of a non-white candidate, a colored candidate. So this is a huge division going on that is, you know, how can we talk about having a nation of Americans when we are so divided, and we are divided along racial lines. This is the thing I'm talking about here. This is what we need to keep in mind. We are divided. Sure, there are lots of issues that we're divided on, but they all come down to race. And the most important issue, is race. And we need to, not that we don't know it. Those of you who are listening to me know it. Some people might listen to this program later on who don't exactly know it or who have a little difference of opinion with me, so that's good. But mostly it's the people, all kinds of people, that we need to get this through to them. And this election was a national election for all Americans. And so, you know, this is a lesson for all Americans, and we need to try to help people to learn this lesson. So, in Maryland, for example, Obama won only 43% of white voters. So even in Maryland, the whites voted, even in Maryland, so close to Washington, D.C., you know, and where so many government employees live and people who make money off the government or people who run businesses that, you know, mainly are, the government is their customer and so on. In Maryland, even there, the whites voted a majority for the white candidate, but the blacks gave Obama 97% of their vote. That accounted for a 62% majority. So if more whites had voted for Romney. And of course, I realize there are a lot of people, a lot of whites who did not want Romney to win, are very happy he didn't win. And not that they like Barack Obama, but they think that this will be better in the long run for our strategy and all of this. So I understand that. I understand. I'm not putting Romney up as the ideal person that we would want to lead us. I'm only pointing out that he was the white and Republican candidate, and that and how people voted along racial lines. So then Henry Wolf asked the question, how could Mr. Romney have won this election? Well, he says, because 7 times as many white as Hispanic voters, there are just 1.5% more of the white vote. If Romney had gotten 1.5% more of the white vote, he would have carried the popular vote. So there are 7 times, according to his figuring, 7 times as many white as Hispanic voters. That's pretty good. You know, that's because so many Hispanics don't vote still, isn't, even though the number who do vote keeps increasing every election. And more Hispanics and more blacks, and I believe more Asians voted this time than they did last time, even though it was the whites who didn't vote, who weren't voting as much this time. I'm not sure that there were it showed that they all were, maybe there weren't more black voters, but there were more Hispanic voters for sure this time. And the Hispanic voters are the ones they call them Hispanic, you know. I don't agree with that word, but I'm using it here because that's what they're using. They are very poor. They have a very poor record of voting. Blacks have a much better record in voting, but they have a lot of turnout to vote. They've been around longer. Maybe that's part of it. But anyway, 7 times as many white as Hispanic voters. And if Romney had won just 1.5% more of the white vote, Henry Wolf says he would have carried the popular vote. So you see that, our problem is that whites are not voting for whites. You know, in one case, not all the whites are voting because they're turned off. And then in another, when they do vote, they're not voting. There's not enough of them voting for whites. There's a nice chart here, but it shows that the difference in a lot of states, a lot of these that were considered swing states, in which Obama actually won just about all of these, the difference was only like. The difference between if there was a larger white vote there, it would have been a white victory. It would have been a Romney victory. Was like the average 3% difference. So for the lack of 3% in the vote, if there had been 3% more people, more white people voting for the white candidate would have won. Now let's go to Asians. Asians voted for Mr. Obama. They call him Mr. Obama. Well, this is American Renaissance. Everybody is Mr., like in the New York Times. Asians voted for Mr. Obama at an even higher rate than Hispanics. Okay, this is kind of a surprise. And they voted 73% for Obama. Asians did. Hispanics voted 71%. Those are really high numbers. It just shows, you know, they're just totally in the Democrat column, and they prefer probably a non-white candidate. You think there's not going to be non-white candidates? Well, the Republicans are already mentioning Hispanic candidates for president for 2012. Marco Rubio and a couple of others. I can't think of them offhand. Their names might come up further down here. There are more Asians that voted than ever before, and they're a steadily growing majority of them vote Democrat. In 2004, 55% voted Democrat. In 2008, 63% voted Democrat. And in this 2012, it was jumped up to 73% of vote Democrat. So they're in that column. They're anti-Republican too. And in a sense, Kevin McDonald made a statement in his article that we're going to discuss, that Republican Party has become the party of white people. And he said that. I've noticed him saying that several times in the past. So these people are voting against the party of white people. They're voting against white people. And a lot of these liberal white people want to go along with them and say, yeah, we're against white people. So what does this portend for white people? Very, very bad, unless we can increase this idea that whites need to stick together with whites in order to survive. Although there's so many that already are. I recently reconnected with a friend, male ex-boyfriend from college, not anything romantic or anything like that, just kind of happened, and he contacted me, and so, you know, we just, because it's kind of fun to somebody from back in college days and so on, we've done some emailing, and he's a really great guy. He's a really fine human being. I liked him a lot then, and he's got these qualities of strength and solidity, and he was a successful businessman. He had four sons. His first wife divorced him after he became a born-again Christian. And so he is a born-again Christian, and he's obviously a Christian Zionist, because he thinks the Jews are just fine, and he's anti-Muslim. So he's got that problem that so many of them have. That's true. That's a problem that so many of them have. But he, as well as some other people that I know who I would have to say are probably Christian Zionists, are still wonderful people. These are wonderful people. These friends I have, some people I know here that, you know, I know fairly well, a couple, they are wonderful people. But they're caught in that belief, you know, that they got into in their churches. And I would not write these people off. Anyway, this man I'm talking about, he is a Republican leader in his state, and he was all kind of caught up in this, and I don't think he had a whole lot of hope. But at the end, after the debate started, he started getting more enthused. I don't know, because it was just around that time that we connected again. And he works hard for it. he contributes a lot. He's one of these people that, you know, always he's always active and contributing to the world around him. But he said to me when I, because I told him some of my views on race, and he thought I was kind of bigoted. But then he said, well, he thinks that eventually we'll just all Americans will just be kind of brown. And, you know, he left it at that. You know, he just, and so many people do. They're inside, they've accepted it because they see it as inevitable. They don't see that they can, he's not a liberal. He's not working for that. But he doesn't want to be racist, see? He said that, you know, he doesn't believe in that. And so what are you left with? You're left with saying, well, we're all going to be brown. That's it. So if you don't like that, then you're on a different wavelength. But I just don't feel like people like him are totally lost. Although they're not totally lost, but they need to hear the right message. So when the vote splits like this along racial lines, Henry Wolf continues. We were talking about the Asians and the Hispanics voting so heavily for the Democrat. When the vote splits like this along racial lines, it is always said that the white candidate failed to do enough to win minority votes, as though the key to victory is always minority votes, and we have to have the minorities. I mean, that's the in political correctness and in establishment politics, that goes without saying. Oh, you've got to get those minorities. You've got to get those minorities. So that's what they're saying right now. The Republicans are already saying, well, we need to go after those Hispanics. I think I already mentioned that. But, however, to show how it is racially biased in this country, when in our political establishment, when the black candidate loses millions of white votes from one election to the next, well, actually, they say that Barack Obama got a few million less votes in this election than he did from white people than he did in the last one. There's no soul searching about that, about how he should be appealing to whites. And that's true. Nobody expects any non-white to appeal to whites, to do anything to appeal to whites. And this is a good point, but it's kind of at the same time moot because no one cares, you know. But, you know, if you say that whites have abandoned Mr. Obama, you can just write that off as those whites are racist. You don't say that Obama failed to look after the interests of whites. But if it's the other way around, well, it's the white candidate has to be appealing to these non-whites in their votes. But if whites voted together as a block, if we voted as a block, we wouldn't need to do that because we're still in the majority by far, particularly among the electorate, those who vote. And we could win everything and we could get this country back in our hands again. But, that's the other agenda is the one that's winning out. And another thing that, you know, I haven't said yet, or maybe I kind of mentioned it, but, is that in all of this article here and the other one I'm going to talk about, there's no mention of Jews, of course. Jews are cast in with the white voters, but they're not voting like white voters. Jews are actually voting heavily for the Democratic candidate. They're voting with non-whites, but they don't have a category of their own. And we know that the power that they control in the media has a whole lot to do with why whites don't function together as a bloc, and they think it's very wrong to do so. Now let me see where I am here. they're bringing. This is only going to get worse because they want to bring in more and more non-whites. And of course now Obama will try to give this amnesty to all the illegal aliens and give them voting rights and full rights of all kinds. And so that will add 11 or 12 or 13 million or something. And then we have the regular immigration that's going on. And everybody seems to be to kind of take this as a fait accompli. But we do have the Republican controlled House. If they can, they could hold the line on that. However, if they're under this idea that they have to, that we now have to pander, the Republicans have to pander to Hispanics and what they want. And that has started up and is going real strong already. All these Republicans saying, well, we have to retool here and take a new look at this and what we need to do. And that could very well be a part of it. I wouldn't be surprised. So this, you know, instead of, if we could take charge now, we could take charge. We still have enough of a majority, but if we don't do it now, things are going to change very fast, very fast. Lots going to change in the next 4 years because of this failure of ours. So to continue here with Wolf, he says, for decades, Republicans were willfully blind while immigration whittled away their natural support base. Very true. Very true. And now, he says, the GOP is in a terminal crisis of its own making. Well, it's his own making, but it's a making of whites in general. I don't know. The GOP has had, I don't know if it's his, I don't know. But you can say that for certain. I mean, they certainly didn't really work it. They didn't let themselves be the white party. They're afraid of that. So they tried to play what they felt they had to, considering the media, you know, influences abounding. So I don't really know that they had a whole lot of choice if they wanted to remain a political politically viable. But still, it didn't show courage. They don't show courage. There's no courage. The other article I was going to bring up has an interesting chart. And it says that this chart shows the number of votes cast by race, ethnicity in 2012 and 2008. And it shows that among white voters, that white voters account for almost 92 million. 92 million white people voted in 2012, just, you know, November 6th in early voting. And 16.5 million African Americans voted. 12.5 million Hispanics voted. And then others votes were 6,383,000. Well, others, that's not very much for others, 6 million. That's because Jews and more importantly, Middle Eastern people, Arab type people. I don't know what, you know, I don't know exactly what to call these people, but they're considered white. They're in with the white column, but they don't vote white. They don't think white, and neither the Jews nor some Hispanics are in with the whites, but mostly they're just you might call them Middle Eastern types or something. And so to take those out from the white votes, I don't know how many to take out, but I just, to be on the generous side, I'd take out 20 million of them, which leaves 72 million, say, around 70 million for, to be sure, really white voters. And the other voters, I added that up here, the other non-white voters add up to 35.5 million. You know, we beat them there, 71 million. Oh, no, well, I didn't add that other 20 million in that I took off from the 91. So that would be, it's close. That would be 55.5 million non-whites. This is very rough. And as against 71 million whites. So you can see that when we don't have solidarity according to race like they do have it, but we don't have it. We can't depend on our 71 million voting together for a white candidate over a non-white candidate. People get fooled by all the issues that they bring in, and you don't know how much truth there is to them. All this talk about Romney and his what a terrible guy he is, and of course I don't like Mormonism either, but still I bit the bullet on that one. And that he's, you know, so in love with Israel, true. And I bit the bullet on that one. Well, but you don't know what's going to come of that. You don't know that it's going to be any worse than the other guy. But at least you know that in some of the areas, he really would stand up for white people and white interests. He really would have. And of course, Obama is not going to at all. So we're in for 4 years of eroding, the things that, that we feel are important to us in this country, which is our home. So this article kind of points out that from all the, you know, there was a lot of the guy did a lot of analysis and so on, and basically comes to the conclusion that what happened in this election was that white voters stayed home. Too many white voters stayed home. And that is, I think, the surprise, the shock that the Romney campaign got, that so many people thought that he was going to win. They had me convinced that maybe he was going to win, although I really couldn't quite believe it. But because these white voters, so many white voters didn't show up. Let's see, there's a, I don't know where I have those numbers if they're so important, he talked about he said who he asked in this article who were these whites and why did they stay home. Well, he looked at his own state of Ohio, and the numbers looked bad, but in the end Romney only lost Ohio by something over 1%, but 1% is a lot of votes. So, you know, it's, but still, you know, it wasn't that it was so, so large a win in Ohio for Obama. And the, but he said that the counties, in the rural portions in the Southeast, especially, where there's a hard hit by recession, unemployment is high, and, you know, the people aren't so wealthy, and working class whites. And he said that voting there was down quite a bit from 4 years ago. And, he thinks his judgment, although he's still working on it, thinking about it, but his first judgment is that Romney's wealth and his tenure at Bain Capital may have turned these people off to him because they didn't feel like he was the man who would, you know, represented the interests of the white working class. And, that you hear a lot of talk about that, but he would have represented the interests of the white working class a hell of a lot better than Barack Obama is going to do. Still, campaigns, people take in a lot of information, a lot of propaganda. In a state like Ohio, they had, and people watch TV, you know, so they had campaign ads on TV like crazy. And, you know, people get influenced by these things. I didn't see a single campaign, television campaign ad because I haven't watched any TV. And they didn't have that many, I suppose, here in Texas. If I did watch TV. But anyway, you know, they influence people really too much. And so this man says that given the choice between two unpalatable options, these voters just stayed home. And I can understand that because I was going to stay home, you know, and of course I don't live in a swing state, but a lot of people, I believed in staying home at that, you know, most up until just recently, I thought, well, you know, why should I get into this stupid? Why should I waste my time? And it's better not to vote. Well, it's turned out, in my opinion now, that it's not. This is a catastrophe to have four more years of Barack Obama. And I really disagree with those people, those white nationalists who are saying that this will turn out better for us because it will drive whites to white nationalism. I'm not so sure about that. I'm really not at all sure about that. But that's a discussion that can continue for a long time, actually. So this man ends up saying that elections, makes a statement that I think is pretty good. Elections are decided on who shows up, not on who might have shown up, right? So and the party people know that. That's why they're so busy trying to get voters out to vote. Now, here's something that made an impression on me that I'll mention that I read just the other day. I don't know where it was or what the context was now, but I think it must have been from exit polls that they said the number of people, I think it was something like 15%. I don't remember it very well, but that kind of sticks in my mind. But it was enough of a percentage that it caused me to really notice and think about it, that this many people said that they didn't make up their mind until they got into the voting booth. They didn't know who they were going to vote for until they got into the voting booth, 15%. And I feel like these are people who were voting late. These were some of the people that were being asked questions. How can you not know who you're going to vote for president until you get in the booth? So I'm thinking, talking about, you know, getting out the vote. Sometimes they're just rounding up these people on election day, and particularly as it gets later. They find those who haven't gone yet, and they're out there. They've got whole crews of, you know, out there dragging them in. And a lot of these are, of course, you know, mostly on the Democratic side. These are minorities who they're dragging in there to vote. And they don't even know who to vote for. They just go in there, and then they say, oh, I got to mark this ballot. Well, never know what they do, but they would probably vote for the president if they're a minority, but they just hadn't even given it any thought. And this, of course, speaks a lot in terms of those who say that we shouldn't, this push to have everybody who even stands on this soil to be voting is such a mistake. But let me end this hour by saying that who is this from? This is from Joe. Joe wrote an email, and I'm just going to read the last part of it here and comment. If the Republicans hope to win on the... Now, again, Joe is not a really Republican, but he's very pro-white. Very pro-white. And he's not a liberal. So, you know, you end up... preferring the Republican presidential candidate over the Democratic, especially in these days. So he says, if the Republicans hope to win on the national stage in the future, the best strategy is to become more white. They must drop any pretense of appealing to minority voters. Okay, and how much, of course, if you don't, you know, excuse me, if you're not trying to appeal to minority voters, well, you should be kicked right out of the game, you know, according to the common wisdom, because that's just stupid. That's just ridiculous. This is a land of immigrants and minorities, and we all, you know, we have to make them out to be important. Otherwise, we're discriminating against them if we're not trying to get their vote, if we're only going after white people. But, of course, Joe is saying what the best strategy is, not that, but is to become more white. He says the white youth who voted Democratic largely because their liberal attitude on social issues should be targeted. He didn't write that very well, but the white youth voted, they should be targeted. Okay, should be targeted. Yeah, I didn't read it right. The white youth who vote Democratic because of their, they should be, because of their liberal on social issues. They're not thinking about race at all. They're thinking about, what kind of social issues. But he says that if that's their interest, the best appeal should be an absolute opposition to affirmative action and racial set-asides in college admissions and hiring. He says that, these young men, mostly, should be talked to about affirmative action and racial set-asides, and that's what they should care about more than their social issues. In the same way with where'd that go? The same way with he says if they want to legally smoke a joint or something, is that more important than getting a seat in the college of their choice on a level playing field? Things like that. He says legalization of gay marriage should not be more important than the hiring process that does not give a preferential treatment to racial minorities. So, these are the kind of things that a Republican Party could be talking about, but they're afraid to do so. Well, I've run out of time in my first hour. I want to remind you that I'm hoping that Kevin McDonald will call in, as he said he would, after the second hour gets underway. So we'll be taking our break now. This is Carolyn Yeager at the this is the Heretics Hour. Stay with me until after this musical break.
Es ist einer dieser Tage, an die wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang. Und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht, und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Sie erzählt von einer Zeit, für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang. Und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second hour of the Heretics Hour on November 12, 2012. The topic tonight is sort of generally the future of white men, white women, white families in America, considering the political situation that we are dealing with today. I am waiting now for Professor Kevin McDonald to call, but I told him about 7:04 or so I wasn't sure how the break music goes in the hour, you know, what the time is. So it might be a couple more minutes yet, or a few minutes before that happens. I'm hoping to discuss his newest article at the Occidental Observer, and I know he's quite willing to discuss that. It's called Disenfranchised White Males, Time for Secession. Secession is the act of withdrawing from an organization, union, or especially a political entity. Of course, we all know what it means politically, but I admit I've never studied about secession. I'm just familiar with it in a general sense of what it involves, and it always sounds kind of exciting. Of course, there was a serious movement to in Texas to secede from the union. That was before I lived here, but Texans are kind of but Texas is a huge state and could do very well. But, you know, all right, I'm getting the call. Let me bring up my my window and do my little deal here. 1, 4, 3, 2. I should do it. Let's see if he comes on. There he is. Hello, Professor McDonald. He's getting on. Hello, Professor McDonald. Can you hear me? There. We hear you. We've connected. Professor McDonald, you can't hear me, huh? I don't know if I can get you up on my, see, I don't have you as a personal contact, so I can't, I wonder what the problem is. Do you have your sound on? Let's see if Tan Staffel is listening, if he can help out any, because Professor McDonald is here. And I hear him doing some things on his keyboard. The line is open. We're connected. but he doesn't seem to be hearing me. That's too bad. I can't send him a message either, because he didn't make the personal connection with me. He might be typing to me, but I don't get anything. Gosh. Maybe he may, no, we hear him, so it must be that he doesn't hear me. I don't know. Professor McDonald, can you hear me? No, obviously not. I need to send him an email, but I don't know. Oh, man. I can't give him... Uh-oh. I don't hear him anymore. Sounds like he dropped off. Yeah, but he's calling again, but I think it's the same number. It's on the same line, so I don't know if this is going to work. Darn. He's still on the line, so I can't bring him in.
Hello?
Okay, there you are.
Yeah.
All right, fine. I was, we were connected all along, but I could hear you. We could hear you, but you didn't hear me, obviously.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay.
All right, great. Well, welcome to the show. I'm very, very happy to have you here.
I'm sorry for the mess up there.
Oh, that's all right. I'm just glad that we got through that, because I know the listeners are anxious to hear you. Well, I've been talking about the election results and what they tell us about our situation, you know, as white people. And the basic point I've made was that we need to vote white. We need to work harder to become a white bloc, political bloc. And following up from that, then I would like for you, I'd like to discuss your article that I've already introduced to the listeners that you just posted a couple of days ago at the Occidental Observer, Disenfranchised White Males, Time for Secession. And how that, it sounds to me in this article that you are, you have reached a new level of being, fed up, or you're angry that what is happening is something beyond what we should be willing to accept, and it's not acceptable, and we need to do something about it. And it sounds to me like you might be ready for a little more drastic action. I'm not sure. You want to explain anything about what you meant when you wrote this article?
Yeah, it's apparent that white people are coalescing in the Republican Party. I mean, they're getting 90% of the votes from white people. More and more, it's a percentage of the electorate, of the white electorate, are voting Republican every time. Yet the Republican Party doesn't really do anything about that. If Romney had gotten in, he wouldn't have done anything to stem the tide, to stop legal immigration. He may not have given an amnesty quite so quickly as Obama wants to, but he wouldn't have done anything for us. And it worries me that now, unless we can persuade, if you look at the official results, white males were approximately 70% of white males voted Republican, and that's astonishing. That means that it's not about social class anymore. When I was a kid, you know, the Republicans were the business type people. They were, you know, they were at the country club and all that. Whereas the Democrats were the working class. It's not that way anymore. White working class people are voting Republican. Middle class people are voting Republican. Upper middle class is voting Republican. Yet we still couldn't win the election. And because there's this, they've just imported this new electorate. They've imported 40 million people in the last 50 years or so, and they continue 1 million every year, and they're non-white, and they're going to vote in the Democratic Party. And so, yeah, I'm concerned. This seems to be a tipping point. I mean, it's not like say you were a Republican or a conservative in 1992, you know, and Bill Clinton got elected. Well, you say, oh, well, you know, you'd go back and you'd try to hone your message and get more people, you know, on the ground or something. But this doesn't seem that way anymore. It seems like there's a tipping point where this is fundamentally about race now. And I think people are aware of this to a great extent. You see more and more commentary in the media that the Republican Party is dead, that if they can't reach out to these new immigrants. But how are they going to do that? I mean, and why would they want to? Their base does not want this. That's why they're in the Republican Party in the first place. And so the Republican Party is going to be a minority party. And from the standpoint of white activism or white consciousness, it seems rather bleak right now. Unless, you know, I just wrote another thing today. I mean, my hope would be that I think that the reaction right now from the Republicans is going to be, how can we appeal to the Mexicans and Latinos and all that? What can we do? And some people are talking about Marco Rubio. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to appeal to get more votes there. Well, we'll see. I just don't think that's going to be effective. They're also, you know, saying that the Republicans should agree to an amnesty. Well, the amnesty, you know, at best is going to split 70-30 in favor of the Democrats. It's not going to help the Republicans in terms of votes. And I just don't think it's going to change perceptions and loyalties. I do think you know, when you have 70% or on average, 80% of non-white Americans are voting Democrat, I think they see it as a racial issue. You look at Asians in particular. Asians, their demographic profile, you know, a lot of them are very well off. They're educated and all that, but they're still voting Democrat, just like the Jews are. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not about social class anymore. It's about ethnic affiliation. And white people are, you know, the problem with us, of course, is that we still have fairly large percentages of white people who are voting Democrat for one reason or another. But, you know, every election, it's more and more white people are voting Republican, independent of their social class and everything else. It's the racialization of American politics. And I think it's a logical outcome of multiculturalism. That's what's going to happen. We are going to feel, you know, we built the country, we were the country, and we're seeing it taken away from us.
Well, do you think that there's, I've got several questions concerning what you just said. Do you think that there's enough time for this to work itself out so that whites become more and more solidified? Or do you think we could make a big leap in the next 4 years because of the results that we can talk about in this past election?
Well, my problem, my concern with that is that the Republican Party elites are going to squelch anything like that. They're going to try to do everything they can to prevent the sort of labeling of the Republican Party as the white party. They are going to go out of their way to, you know.
And don't you think that there's a lot of that there's the Jews in the Republican Party are they're already doing that. They're already talking about how we have to do
absolutely.
The amnesty.
That was the topic of my blog today. This is a JTA article. The Jewish Republicans are advocating amnesty, you know, and they're not saying anything about legal immigration. And they're talking about gay marriage and stuff like that. That's what the Republicans have to do to win. They have to be in favor of gay marriage and amnesty.
Man.
You know, it's so pathetic.
Yeah.
But yes, that's because that, you know, Jews, the fact is those are mainstream Jewish political issues. And now they want the Republican Party to sign on to that. Well, I don't think the Republican base is ready for gay marriage and or illegal immigrants. And you know, the amazing thing is these Republicans don't want to, these Jewish Republicans don't want to talk about legal immigration. But if we don't stop legal immigration, the Republican Party is toast. I mean, they can't possibly win more than one more election unless they start getting 70, 75, 80% of the white vote, which, you know, could happen, but we're a ways away from that. I mean, you still have a lot of white liberals who are, you know, benighted. They're the good people. They're not racist. They, you know, there's just that mentality that you find in, like, San Francisco or Marin County or, you know, that's the attitude that they have. Well, so we can't get all white people here on board with this.
No, we can, doesn't seem like we can. And I was talking about that in the first hour, that if we could do that, we would have it made, but we can't do that. So now, what about pro-white groups that, you know, that we're all familiar with amongst our own people who are saying, who have been very much against the Republican Party, and they're saying, well, this is great if the Republican Party in another 4 years just falls off the cliff altogether, then these white people will have to come to us, to white nationalist organizations of one kind or another. Do you see any viability in that?
Well, I do think that 2016 is going to be pivotal. I think that between now and 2016, the people who run the Republican Party are going to go with this idea of appealing to Latinos. And they are going to, you know, maybe even gay marriage. I don't know. But I don't think that's going to work. And in 2016, they're going to be back to square one. And at that point, I think that maybe white people and everybody's going to wake up to the fact that they just can't win anymore. And they're going to have to be explicitly white. I mean, if they were explicitly white, I think that they could. The problem with that is, of course, we don't have the media, and any expression of explicit whiteness is vilified. It's equal to Nazism and all that stuff. I do think that white America is going to be in a crisis. Is starting now. I think that an awful lot of people are thinking after this election, you know, they're thinking, what is the future really going to be like for white people? And can we really, you know, determine elections anymore? I mean, it was taken for granted when you and I were growing up, and everybody, I think until very recently, you know, that white people basically ran the country. And if either the Democrats or Republicans, different sets of white people, but it's not that way anymore. And I think we are at a watershed. What I'm trying to do in my writing is just make people aware this is a tipping point. We have to start really getting serious about this. And you know, my hope would be that yes, eventually, maybe after 4 years, maybe before, that white people are going to wake up. I mean, we have things like the American Third Position Party that I was affiliated with. We are taking a view, you know, opposed to immigration and advocating white interests. You know, if the Republican Party doesn't do it, maybe somebody else will. I mean, I don't think the Republican constituency is going to be happy as a minority party in non-white America. I just don't think they are.
Well, yeah. So, you know, let's finish with the Republican Party here. Do you think that there's it's still possible that they might, you know, wake up enough that they might do something when they see where they're going? Maybe if they could shake off some of these Jewish Republicans or shake off the need to go along with the media and not be vilified like they will be. They could, but I don't know if there's anybody in the Republican Party that I'm not that familiar with it, actually.
Yeah, who's there in the Republican Party that's willing to do that?
Yeah.
You know, the real sort of traditional paleoconservative people have been purged from the party, you know, beginning in the Reagan era, you know, when the neocons got the upper hand. And, you know, these neocons are basically Jewish liberals who have taken over the Republican Party. The blog I did today refers to an article I wrote about that. I mean, it's just a common knowledge that people like Pat Buchanan had been pushed out. People like Sam Francis, all these people that used to be, you know, sort of mainstream Republicans, paleoconservatives. That's just gone practically now. And so you have these financier types, you've got neocons and big Jewish money now. I mean, one of the problems the Republican Party has of getting rid of Jews is they get rid of an awful lot of money because, even you know, with the Republican Party, I guess 40% of the money at least comes from Jews. That's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And if there's any hint that the Republican Party was going to be a white party and explicitly white and start to oppose immigration, well, that money would be gone tomorrow.
Do you think that I think we need to talk more about the Jews. We need to point out the negative effect of the Jews, and there's a lot of people who don't want to do that. But I think that we can't get anywhere unless we start doing that. And I know you do talk about Jews quite a bit, but I don't know. I don't think your party does.
No,
I don't think your party wants.
You mean the American Third Position?
Yes, right.
Yeah, we don't. Well, the fact that I'm on the board and there are a couple other people on the board, I think it's sort of implicit that we are aware of Jewish issues. We don't have anything to specifically say, like on our platform. Our platform revolves around immigration and sovereignty. I mean, the issue on sovereignty really is American foreign policy vis-a-vis Israel, that we've been dragged into these wars because of Israel and Israel lobbying this country. And so that's a huge issue of sovereignty. We do talk about those things, but then
the Republican Party is so much associated with being allied with Israel. The whole thing gets almost, you almost can't find a way to make anything work because, you know, I think we need to focus on domestic issues, but then the most convincing way to show what the Jews are doing negatively to us is really through foreign policy, isn't it?
Although, I think that's right. I mean, that's the easiest one to get people on board with because it's very clear the role of the Israel lobby. And there's a lot written on it by a lot of different people. It's not like it's all that secret. I mean, and you have Stephen Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer, the professors from Harvard and from the University of Chicago who have written that wonderful book on the Israel lobby. So that's more mainstream and well-known. So that is the point of entry, I think, as far as Jewish influence goes, is the Israel lobby in this country. But then you have to get way beyond that and start talking about the Jewish role in immigration and the Jewish role in multiculturalism and in sort of disestablishing Christianity and the basic white identity of this country. That is also part of it. But that's deeper. You have to read a book. I mean, it's not something you can really argue very well in sound bites. You have to read I wrote The Culture of Critique. It's like, 350 pages or something. So it takes an argument that you have to lay out. Very few people are willing to get into that. But the fact is Jews are an elite. They're a powerful group. They're very wealthy. They are around 35% of the billionaires in this country. You look at the political donations. They're very involved politically. Wealthy Jews direct their money to Jewish causes, and that includes the Democratic Party, includes the Israel lobby, includes the Republican Party, both sides of the aisle. And so they are very active, and they know what they're doing with their money. They have a huge influence in the media. Almost all the media, big media in this country, is owned by Jews, Jewish corporations. So Hollywood, I mean, it's a very wealthy, very, very much of an elite group, and we have to start talking about their influence. And of course, that is the thing that they don't want. I mean, they want to the whole idea of Jewish influence is off the table. Now, when WASP ran this country, in the 1950s or 40s or something like that, they were always the power of the WASP was always talked about. But now that we have this new Jewish elite. And they're very, very influential in a lot of areas, and we can't talk about it. I mean, this is the elite that cannot tell its name. And so we are basically left to be on these internet radio shows and my website on the internet, and we talk to maybe thousands of people, but they're talking to hundreds of millions of people. And so it's a big disconnect. And they are up all the high grounds right now. They have all the high cards, but there's a lot of unhappy white people. And I think that losing this election is probably really crushing to a lot of white people. You think about it, the economy was just terrible, and Obama still got reelected.
Mm-hmm.
It's just astonishing.
He
has nothing to show for anything in terms of employment, the jobs, and the whole economy. And yet he got reelected.
People are blaming it on Romney for not doing a good enough campaign.
Yeah, he didn't. But, if he'd done a better campaign, he would have gotten more votes from white people, basically. The point is that American politics have become racialized. And that is, I think, the message of this election. I mean, I've been saying it actually ever since 2008. It's probably true before that to a certain extent. But, I think it's becoming apparent to everybody now. And in a way, that's good because it wakes white people up. It makes them more conscious of being white. I mean, I think when I was growing up, when I was young, I never really thought of myself as white, or if you did, it was just sort of taken for granted, And like I said, both Republicans and Democrats were white, basically. So it just wasn't, that's not that way anymore.
Yeah, I think you're right that you put it so well, too, that the political process has become racialized, and that's the big message. Since that is the message, can we include talking to people about Jews in all this? Because they're the ones who are going to keep it, who are going to try to keep more and more non-white influence in this country so that we can't make use of our white majority at all.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that, there are different approaches that we have to take. I mean, I've obviously taken the approach that somebody has to talk about Jewish issues and try to do it in a educated, factually based, evidence-based way. That's what I am pursuing. But other people decided not to talk about Jewish issues. Jared Taylor, American Renaissance. I have no problem with that. I don't think everybody has to talk about this. I think, there are different strokes for different folks. And maybe he can, convince people to be on the side of white interests. Some people that would not be open to my message. That's fine.
Well, what about, I could understand that, too. But what about allowing Jews into our group, Jews as white people? What is the effect of that? How negative, how much of a problem is that?
Well, I think any group that allows Jews in has to be aware of what they are up to and what they'd be like. I don't know that there are no Jews affiliated with American Third Position. I think Jared Taylor has had some Jewish speakers and so on. I think that people involved in, say, something like American Renaissance, and they allow Jews to have a certain role, they should at least be conscious of and be wary about the possibility that Jews could eventually try to have a really big influence on it. And I do think that these people would be aware of that. They would not allow that to happen. But there's no question that having Jews in an organization is going to give it, they're going to start pursuing Jewish interests. And Jewish interests uniformly has been in favor of multiculturalism and a massive displacement-level immigration into this country. There's just no significant exceptions across the Jewish political spectrum. None. I can name three or four Jews who are opposed to massive immigration. I can't name one Jewish organization, and there's no significant Jewish power that's not in favor of massive immigration. And again, in my book, The Cultural Critique, I laid out the argument. I laid out the case for the fact that the 1965 law that changed everything in this country was the result of Jewish lobbying and Jewish influence and Jewish money. Mm-hmm. So there's no question where they are. They may be classified as white, but they don't identify with the white European Christian culture that we've had in this country and which is fast disappearing.
Well, could we do a better job, or should we be pointing out? I think so, that Jews are not white. If we talk about you know, coming together as white people and how we're being dispossessed as white people by people who are not white and don't like whites and want to get rid of whites. You know, this is, you know, when we get into it in this serious a way, can we not point out and should we not be pointing out that Jews are not white and that Asians, who so many people like, and I can understand why, and, you know, feel that they're good people and so on, they're not white either. And, you know, if we're going to, how much can we make, can we go into a racial, what?
Well, I think that we...
ghetto.
What?
Racial ghetto.
Well, we have to talk about those issues. I've been asked that question many times. And the answer is that there is a certain percentage of European genes within the Jewish gene pool. That's what the population genetics data say. But mostly they are a Middle Eastern group. They are not really a European group. That's genetically. Psychologically, they are not a European group. That is, they do not identify with white Christian civilization. And in fact, one of the things that I try to drive home in a lot of my writing is that Jews have this sort of atavistic hatred towards European culture and Christianity because they perceive all this persecution against Jews over the centuries. That is the reality. And so they, when they think of the Middle Ages, they think of pogroms, they think of expulsions, they think of, when they think of 19th century, they think of the Tsar and persecutions in Eastern Europe and all that. And then they think of the Holocaust. That's how they see the West. So they do not identify with us culturally, and they are not really part of the European gene pool. So that it makes a lot of sense not to think of them as our people at all, that they are not our people. They are classified as white. Actually, back 100 years ago, they wanted to have a Jewish category on the census, but the Jews opposed it. They would rather be seen as white people. So, you know, they talk about, you know, white people run Hollywood. No, white people do not run Hollywood. Jews run Hollywood. And that's a very big difference.
Well, I think that there's an awful lot of white groups or people who are supposed to be among us who don't like to make that distinction, and who find too many Jews that they think are friendly and they like and so on. I think, you know, just how far can we go? How much should we do? And, you know, you're quite a leader, Professor McDonald, and you're very influential. And I know you've said all these things, but do you think you should, in this next 4 years, say, since this election cycle, try to bring that out to people more and more? Or do you think that's a losing proposition?
Well, it is something that I'll continue to write about. I mean, I've written about it many times, and because it keeps coming up, you know, Jews are white people. No, they're not. And it's a very clear argument. It's very easy to make. And I've written a couple articles that I can easily, you know, link to. So that argument's been made, and I, you know, it comes up quite often. Jewish attitudes, and there's some great quotes, like from Elliot Abrams, Michael Kinsley, you know, just talking about the Jewish antipathy towards Christians and Christian culture in America. They basically don't trust it. They hate it. And, you know, the general thrust of Jewish political activity in this country has been to disestablish Christianity, to get as many non-Christians into this country as possible, to take Christianity out of the public square, and all that. I mean, it's very clear what they have done here. And it's very well documented. But I'll continue to write about it.
Yeah, you do. And, you know, when you write answers or criticisms or whatever, analyses of articles written by Jewish writers, that's actually what you're doing. Sometimes I think, well, why are you keep talking about these Jews and what they're writing? But you're actually pointing out, you know, how they're different from us. So I should keep that
quite
in mind.
Often I criticize Jewish writers.
Yeah,
I
mean, that's a
huge amount of what I do is criticize them. Point out their blind spots, point out their biases, and that sort of thing, because nobody else does it. I mean, you just don't see it in the mainstream media. Jews are like a sacred cow or something. And so you can't talk about Jewish influence. You can't talk about Jewish involvement, say, in the war in Iraq. You can't talk about that in above ground media, at least not much. I mean, there are a few breakthroughs. I mean, again, that is the issue. I think the easiest issue, as you were saying before, the easiest issue to get people involved in this, in Jewish issues, is the Israel army. I mean, and that's a huge issue. Because, you know, I think there's going to be a huge campaign now to get us to go to war against Iran. And, the Israeli government under Netanyahu did their best to get us to go to war during the presidential campaign. They were trying to play off the two parties against each other to see if they could get a war during that period. But Obama didn't bite, and Romney backed off. And so now... it's going to have to wait. I think maybe January, February, we're going to see a huge push to have a war with Iran.
And you think that so many people think that Obama is going to stand up against this, that he's, you know, got some good stuff going in him, and he doesn't really like Netanyahu. He hates Netanyahu. He doesn't like Israel and so on. Do you go along with that?
Basically, yeah, to some extent I do. I think that Obama... I think that the tensions are real. On the other hand, you know, Israel was asking us to bomb Iran. I mean, that's a huge, huge thing. And a lot of presidents would have balked at that, I think. But I think Obama, you know, because he's black, I think, and because I really do believe that Obama is a radical, I think he's basically a Marxist, I do think that he would hesitate, you know, using American military power against this non-white, this Middle Eastern country, Iran. I think that he has a fundamental sympathy with the Palestinians. I think he's an honest leftist. But he can only do so much. The American presidents are surprisingly not so powerful when it comes up to the Israel lobby. Every American president since Jimmy Carter has opposed the settlements. Has that made a difference? No. I mean, every
it's
American
incredible, isn't it? That's
since
thing.
1968 or whatever has opposed the settlements. And the settlements are still there. They're still growing. And now the only talk is, you know, are we going to really, you know, how are we going to get rid of the Palestinians, basically? I mean, they're not. The American presidents do not have that much power when it comes to Israel.
No. And that's because, and some people say, well, it's all those Republican congressmen.
And, well, yeah, there are a lot of Republicans and Democrats who are on board. This is basically bipartisan. But I would suppose at this point, you're probably right, that it's more centered in the Republican Party than the Democrat Party. This is an argument that Norman Pratt Horowitz has made repeatedly. He wants Jews to vote Republican because he thinks Republicans would be better, more prone to that. I think that's partly because of this evangelical thing. I think it's also partly because it's sort of cover for being conservative. I think it's a way that conservatives can be respectable by invoking their love for Israel. You couldn't possibly be a racist if you support Israel so much. You know, you're supporting Jewish interests. And, of course, there's a lot of money. Republican congressman, any congressman who goes against the Israel lobby is going to get a huge amount of money directed towards his opponent. They know how that works, and so they're going to do it. You know, they're going to knuckle under. I think Paul Ryan's a good example of that. I don't think he's philosophically, he really cares much one way or the other, but he, you know, has a record now of supporting the Israel lobby all the time. His real issues are probably much more fiscal and related to the American economy and, you know, conservative issues, traditional conservative issues, you know, self-reliance and all that, Ayn Rand influence. But, yeah, he's carried water for the Israel lobby. And I think it's just political expediency. I mean, if he wants to get, power in this country, if you want to get power in the Republican Party, you better do that. You better show that very clear. And so these guys compete with each other to be more pro-Israel than now. I mean, the Republican primary debates were just ludicrous to see how these guys were just falling all over each other to try to become more extreme on the Israel thing. Newt Gingrich saying there's no such thing as a Palestinian state or the people. There's no such thing as Palestine. I mean, it just got ludicrous. If you want to rise in the Republican Party, that's how you do it, and they know that.
Well, getting out of that and back into the pro-white groups, do you think that pro-white groups should do a better job of pointing out these things you're talking about the Jews and how the Jews are behind all of these things? There's so many that say, even people in your A3P group, well, we don't want to talk about the Jews all the time. Oh, I'm so, it's always Jews, Jews, Jews. We need to talk about ourselves. Well,
yeah, well,
there's only so much we can do.
I think a lot of it is strategic. People don't want to. If you look at the American Third Position website, I don't think there's any mention of Jews. On the other hand, you see my name as a director. When anybody sees my name, they know what I do and what I write about. So, and other groups like American Renaissance, they don't want to talk about Jews. I think it's tactical. I think that they see that as a possibly better strategy, and they may be right. But the proof is going to be in the pudding. Whoever really gets, influential, whoever pulls it off, my hat's off to them. And I would love it if a pro-white group could succeed and they don't have to talk about Jewish issues and they could become mainstream and really influence policy.
What pro-white groups do you think are doing the best job right now or doing a good job?
Well, it's hard to
put you on the spot.
Weak. I mean, we are unbelievably weak here. And mm-hmm. Jared Taylor's group, my understanding, they only have a few hundred people. American Third Position only has a few hundred people. Probably just got a few thousand votes in this last election. We're not doing well. And the other groups, I can't even think. What other groups do you... Can you
well,
think?
I know. There you go.
I mean, where are we at here? There's just nothing.
There
and
is.
Yet,
well,
if you go to the SPL, the Southern Poverty Law Center website, or the ADL website, you make it sound like there's just thousands of these groups. I'd like to know. There's not one that's really worth mentioning at this point. So we are very weak.
What about the Countercurrents group? Countercurrents.
It's a good group. It's a good group.
Yeah, I figured you'd say that, but. They're trying to create a movement. Okay, I'll go from there to this. You've gone on board with the political party, the A3P, and at the Countercurrents they say, well, political parties are not what we want to do. That's not going to do us any good. We want to create a movement. They're sort of building a movement, for more future that's going to be there for the future. When everything crashes, I think they're looking for everything to crash, and then people will come to them and they'll have something already set up there.
It has to be already set up, that's for sure. And I don't think what's set up now is enough. I mean, you do see, talking about collapse, and collapse could happen. I mean, at some point, people are not going to be buying treasury bonds. It's just, They're floating so much money, people just, they're going to lose credibility. But the people who are going to benefit from this ultimately are those who have the structure in place, and we don't have any structure in place.
Well, we're going to run out of time, and I forgot about the secession. I'm going on too long about this other. We do want to get your opinion on secession, and you brought it up in this article and in the title. And you do say at the end that, if I got the right ending here, you do say in the end that, where's the end? I can't find it. Oh yeah, we don't have any other choice. You say, do white men really have any other choice than to go into these separatist movements?
There are probably other choices. I mean, we could hope that the Republican Party can be turned around. I don't want to say secession or separatism is the only way, but the results of the election depressed me because it's becoming apparent that we are going to be a political minority. We're almost already a political minority. We can't win elections now, and unless we get like 70-75% of the white vote, it's not going to happen. That seems unlikely. What do we do? I want people to have a sense of urgency. That is, this is not something we can just let fester. And, you know, the idea of secession, but I was hoping that, you know, maybe eventually when the Republicans really see that they can't win national elections, that you will see, you know, governors and the state legislatures starting to say, you know, we really got to do this, because if we don't, our state's going to be overrun as well. We're not going to have any power at the national level. We had this federal government's not doing anything for us. At some point, they're going to say that, and I hope that happens.
Well, I do too. I was saying in the first hour about this huge expanse of red on these maps, you know, these voting maps, right. And you see all this huge area, but there's not as many people there as in the little blue areas on the coast and so on. But still, you know, what's you do think that some, I do know that some of these Republican governments, state governments, are pretty unhappy. They don't want to go along at all with what Obama has in mind or the Democrats have in mind. And you think that they might work together to you follow that at all? I don't follow it too much, but to do something serious about it?
Well, I think it's premature at this point, because you know, there is this hope among mainstream Republicans that they can cobble together something that would appeal to a few non-whites and more non-whites. And
well, we don't want to appeal to non-whites.
And they don't. And I don't think the Republican base wants that.
No.
And they're going to have the same problem that in 2016 that they had this year. In the primaries, you're going to have to appeal to the base of the Republican Party. It's conservative. Any candidate goes up there and says, yeah, let's do amnesty, let's do gay marriage, let's, you know, do all this stuff, they're not going to get through the primaries. And so I just don't see this happening. And, you know, if you get a real conservative who's nominated, that guy is just not going to win. And even if 60-some percent of white people vote for him, he's not going to win, because every election, the percentage of the electorate that is white keeps declining. And every year, every election cycle, it's going to take a higher percentage of white people for the Republicans to win. So I just don't think that's going to happen.
So when we look at all these things, when you really take everything into consideration, it looks very hopeless. And, of course, nobody wants to express hopelessness. I don't want to express hopelessness on this program or try to get you to. But it's very, very dire is what you end this article with, you know, expressing that. And that we are, you use the words, we're politically impotent, that when the white people really wake up to the fact that they have become politically impotent, and I think we're actually there, because there's very little we can do politically.
That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get people to say, this is an emergency. You know, let's go. Mm-hmm. We need to do something. You know, we can't just let this keep going. It gets worse every year. And
I think the people who just keep doing what they've been doing, you know, aren't really helping. So, like you say, you know, it's just been sliding along. So I think we have to get tougher. I think
that's why I put secession in the title. I mean, I was thinking, you know, not really going there, but I decided, you know, I got to do something sort of dramatic, because people have to realize this is just not business as usual anymore. I mean, again, it's not like 1992 when it was Clinton versus Bush, you know, and well, if Clinton wins, well, it's not the end of the world. We'll get him 1996 or 2000. We'll come back. It's just not that way anymore. And it's a totally different political game now. And people have to be aware of that. And our influence is declining dramatically. Every year is declining. And we have to wake up if we're going to have a future. So that's what I'm trying to do, is ring the bell. Tell people, hey, wake up.
Yeah, well, good. And you're probably one of the best people to do it. So, you know, you have a lot of responsibility on your shoulders because you have a lot of influence. And there, like you say, there aren't that many. If you try to think of who the leaders are, you can't come up with much of anything. I always come up with you as being the one person who, if I would pick one person from all the whole white movement, white nationalist scene or whatever, it would have to be you for all around the spokesman, you know, the best.
Well, I appreciate that, but at the same time, it's a pathetic statement, isn't it? Because,
well, yeah,
you know, I don't have any power, so. I have a very small audience. I mean, you know, it wouldn't be nice if the leader of the white movement had an audience of 50 million and we had 50 seats in Congress and all that.
Yeah. Well, that's right. That's right. And why don't we have that? This brings me to something I wanted to ask you about, because people are talking so much about the Golden Dawn Party in Greece, and I think people probably put too much hope on that. Because Greece is in, you know, dire straits, and so they are a lot, and it's a much smaller country. It's not at all like the United States. But what is your opinion of what they're doing, and what kind of lessons you think can be taken from that?
Well, there are several parties in Europe now that are making significant headway, and I've often said that when the revolution comes, it will start in Europe. I mean, they are way ahead of us. You have parties like the Golden Dawn. You have the National Front that had a very viable presidential candidate and came in second, as I recall. I mean, in other words, they are far more advanced than we are. Geert Wilders is, you know, you can criticize Geert Wilders all you want, but he wants the Muslims out of Europe. There are other parties in Hungary, the Jobbik Party. They are way ahead of us and light years. And one of my hopes is that one of these parties will win an election. They will form a government and they will survive, because when that happens, the EU is going to be just freaking out and they will do what they can to squelch it. But if a government like that is elected and manages to survive, it will have a big effect. It will make the idea of a white society that's explicitly white, that wants to get rid of immigration, that wants to stay white and Christian, that would be legitimate,
what makes them more legitimate is that they don't say white, they say Greek, or
yeah, they don't
say
have
French,
to, right.
Or they
yeah,
say
they don't
you know
have to. Because they have that history. That's the big advantage that they have over us. I mean, they have this history going back thousands of years. And, you know, we're white and we're we're a sort of a hodgepodge of white people, which I think is fine. You know, I'm not pure anything. I'm mostly German. I'm partly Scottish. That's the way white people are in this country. But I don't think we have the sense of tradition and history that these European countries have. And that's a big advantage that they have.
Yeah, and we're very much attracted to libertarianism, and they don't really have that in Europe. They're not.
We have these movements on the right that are very poisonous. Libertarianism is one, and Christian evangelicalism is another. They just don't get it right. They don't understand the importance of race and ethnicity, and they're often very, very pro-Israel. So, we have these, you know, movements on the right that really are counterproductive, and it's very hard to get those people on page, especially when we don't have a media presence to really get out there our message.
Yeah, that is the main problem, and that's a problem we can't do anything about, it seems. So that is a big problem. Well, yeah. But what do you think of the term white nationalism, and how do you feel about people using that and as a overall name for us?
Well, I've got no problem with white. I think white is a huge history in America. Nationalist is fine. I think we have to experiment with things. I personally like white advocate for no really good reason. I mean, white nationalist is okay. But a white advocate is a little softer, and it gets at the idea that we're just advocating for white interests in the same way that Abe Foxman advocates for Jewish interests and the NAACP advocates for black interests. I mean, that's another entrance to our point of view, by the way. You know, we talked about the Israel lobby being an entrance to Jewish issues. The entrance to white advocacy is simply say everybody else does it. You know, why can't we do it? It's such a no-brainer that anybody can understand that argument.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with that as far as you just logically. But a lot of people say white advocacy is too weak, and white nationalism is stronger. But then white nationalism gets all this criticism, and like you say, you can't argue with white. But is this what we're trying to do? Are we trying to advocate for our interests? Then how does that relate to not wanting to be voted out of, you know, out of power altogether?
Well, you know the reason I like white advocate is simply that it gets you out of the thinking that we're advocates like everybody else. And what the media wants to call you, of course, is white supremacist. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the word they want to impose on you. It's ridiculous, of course, that you know, if for example, in Korea, it would be silly to call a Korean supremacist, somebody who wants to keep Korea Korean and not import 50 million Africans. But that's what they do. They use the words like supremacist. The word nationalist, you know, it has some negative connotations maybe. I'm not opposed to using it if it works. But I think white advocate is, it's not too soft because where it gets at the idea, all we're trying to do is advance our interests like everybody else on the planet. White people are the only people that can't have an identity and can't have interests. That's the way they see it.
Right. Let me ask you, we've only got like a minute or so left. So let me ask you real quick. You talk a bit about California, and of course you live in California, and things looking very bad there. Will most whites be driven out of there? And if so, where would they go? And do you envision yourself leaving California sometime in the future?
Well, yeah, I mean, actually, a lot of white people have left California. That whites have been leaving the state. I don't have the numbers at my fingertips here, but it's been going on for quite a few years. A lot of people who retire, they when they finish their work career in California and they're 55, 60 years old, they move somewhere else. And a lot of them move to the Northwest. They often say an awful lot of California retirees are in Idaho and places like that.
Yeah, well, some of them might be those liberals.
And they might be, but they are escaping California. And white people are going to have to escape.
You think you might join them sometime?
What?
You think you might join them?
I might, yeah. I might. I have two more years on my job after this, so then I have to retire completely, and so then I'm up in the air about what I'm going to do with my life. And California is overrun now. I mean, they have 3/4 majority now in the state legislature. That means they can pass any tax they want. And they're going to tax white people and give it to the invaders.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Professor McDonald, for coming on. It's been very interesting, and I hope you'll come again.
I will. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Good night, everyone.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.